This is What's at Risk on WBZ News Radio 1030 and WBZ.com with Mike Christian of Risk Strategies Company.
Hi, I'm Mike Christian, and welcome to a special encore presentation of What's at Risk. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind. Tonight on What's at Risk, we explore the risk associated with prescription drug abuse and then examine the very real possibility of losing forever the American dream. In segment one, we talk with Joshua Lyon, author of Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict, about his descent into and subsequent recovery from an addiction to prescription painkillers. Then, in our second segment tonight, we'll speak with George Munoz about his new book, Renewing the American Dream, A Citizen's Guide for Restoring Our Competitive Advantage. From politicians to entertainers, the headlines are constantly filled with newsmakers entering rehab, getting into trouble, or overdosing. But the drug of choice is no longer just alcohol or heroin. It is misuse and abuse of prescription drugs. From pain relievers and tranquilizers to ADD medicine and sleeping pills, users' misperceptions of addiction and danger are staggering. On alcohol and pills. Why has the drug of choice shifted? Why do users think prescription drugs are safer, less addictive? The Office of National Drug Control Policy released new data stating that in recent years, the number of individuals who, for the first time, consume prescription drugs for a non-medical purpose exceeded the number of first-time marijuana users. Statistics are staggering to me. Generation RX is definitely among us. Did you know that 48 million Americans have admitted to using prescription painkillers non-medically? That's almost 20% of the population. 9 million Americans are currently abusing prescription drugs. 20% of high school kids abuse prescription drugs. That's 1 in 5. 40% of teens and an almost equal number of parents think abusing prescription painkillers is safer than abusing street drugs. I was old and going on dead, so I had to give it up. More than 29% of teens in treatment are dependent on tranquilizers, sedatives, amphetamines, and other stimulants, which are all types of prescription drugs. Emergency room visits due to prescription overdoses jumped 111% over the last five-year period. What a drag it is getting old. In Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict, national recognized journalist Joshua Lyon exposes the devastating epidemic of prescription painkiller abuse while laying bare his own addiction. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. The internet has made accessing prescription painkillers all too easy. When Joshua first bought Vicodin online with ease for an assignment at Jane Magazine, he found himself becoming dependent on them. Rather than disposing of the pills after the assignment, as per his editor's instructions, he gave in to his curiosity and fell in love. Pillhead is the story of how he came to terms with painful truths and how he has begun to rebuild a life after rehab. And goes running for the shelter of a mother's little helper and to help her on her way. Joshua Lyon is a journalist who has worked for several major publications, including Interview, Condé Nast Traveler, V Life, and Jane. He has also contributed to New York, Out, Vice, and Page Six magazines. He currently writes for a heart publication, and he lives in Brooklyn. Pillhead is his first book.
We are here with Joshua Lyon, the author of Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. Hey! So how pervasive is the use of prescription painkillers and stimulants and other types of prescription drugs in America today?
It's huge, and it's actually grown since I've even started working on the book. Last count, the number was 48 million Americans have abused prescription medication. That's almost 20% of the population. And to give you a sense of just how big that is, that's an increase in 400% over a 10-year period. I didn't even know 400% was an actual number.
Yeah, that's astounding. Your story describes a shockingly easy process to purchase Valium and Vicodin over the Internet. Aren't there supposed to be greater controls in place?
There are, and actually there really are now. This was when I first discovered online pill mills. This was back in 2003. And since then, the DEA has been pretty good about shutting down a lot of the online pill mills. I actually still get people who call my cell phone. I think they've moved on to telemarketing. But after the original websites that I was buying my medications on started to dry up, I eventually just started posting on Craigslist. I would post on MySpace asking people if they had any leftover pills I could buy. And then eventually I just found a regular run-of-the-mill drug dealer that was carrying all these drugs now. And for the most part, most drug dealers out there that also, you know, handle street drugs are carrying these medications.
And they post on Craigslist?
I don't know if they're still posting on Craigslist. I think that's right. Actually a little monitored, too. This was probably about 2005 that I was
gotcha.
Doing that.
Yeah, when did you actually start to write the article and then the book?
It was back in 2003, and I was working at a magazine, and me and all my coworkers started getting spam email that said, buy Vicodin online, no prescription needed. And I was just curious if this was a scam or if this was real. I mean, I knew these were controlled substances. So I talked to my editors and said, I want to do an article, find out if this is real or not. I got a drug budget of $600, and within 48 hours, I had bottles of Valium and Xanax and Vicodin waiting for me on my desk. So it turns out that it wasn't a scam at all. It was very easy, in fact, to get them.
Do you mind telling us a little bit about your descent into addiction and then your subsequent recovery?
I'd certainly had a lot of experiences with drugs in the past. I was, you know, a bit of a party guy, but nothing that really became like debilitating. And because I'd done a lot of drugs in the past, I was curious about Vicodin. I'd heard a lot about it. I knew people who swore by it and loved it. I just wanted to see what all the fuss was about. So my editor made me promise that I was going to throw all the pills out that I had gotten. I lied and said that I would. And ended up taking 3 Vicodin at one time, and my body really, really responded to it. And that's something important to mention, is because not everybody's body will respond to it. There's some people have a really strong adverse reaction, like a nausea. For me, it made me feel really euphoric. It was like being in this very warm blanket. It eased a lot of social anxiety and stress. But what happened is, in order to chase that feeling, you have to keep taking more and more and more until eventually Vicodin became pretty much like baby aspirin to me, and I had to graduate onto harder painkillers like Norco and OxyContin and morphine, Dilaudid.
And so it's not actually a pain-killing effect. It's more of a euphoric, you know, drug-like effect like someone might get with Coke or some of the other street drugs, too.
You know, it was. And I think, I know for a fact that I was self-medicating for an existing issue with depression and anxiety. So in that case, the idea of painkiller became literal and mental. Yes, they were painkillers for physical pain, but for me, I had a lot of emotional pain, too, and they really seemed to help that at first.
Do you think a big reason for the growth in these prescription drugs is that maybe they're more acceptable from a perception standpoint in the public's eye than street drugs?
Yeah, definitely. The perception is that they are very safe. And the important thing to remember is that when used correctly, these are safe, and they're actually very important medications that need to be made available to people who need them. They're the only things that are giving a lot of, you know, say, cancer patients any sense of peace. They help people heal from surgery. But there is this presumed element of safety with them. There's the idea that because somewhere down the line you think a pill came from a doctor instead of, you know, a meth lab, so you think it's safe. But that's it's a total misconception. And one of the you know, I don't think anybody's going to die from taking one or two Vicodin. What happens is people die when they take Vicodin and then they mix it with, say, you know, a Valium or an ADHD drug that they have a legal prescription for. It's really, really dangerous to mix these medications with anything else that's affecting the central nervous system. And that includes, you know, alcohol and those anti-anxiety medications and ADHD drugs.
When you talk about safety, what about the quality of these drugs if you buy them from a, you know, a street dealer, or, you know, you used to buy them online? Are they don't necessarily all come from pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's the other really, really dangerous thing if you don't know where your medication is coming from. I mean, obviously it's dangerous as well if you're stealing it out of, you know, your parents' medicine cabinet, but it's extremely dangerous if you are getting it from a drug dealer or if you do happen to find an online source that's still up and running, because there are drug organizations that are just creating these pills. You can get, I went to the DEA museum and they have examples of these like pill stamping machines where people can put basically anything they want in a pill and say that it's, you know, an OxyContin, but you don't really know because it's stamped to look exactly like it. But you're exactly right. You don't always know what exactly is in them.
That to me would be almost as disconcerting as the addictive nature of them.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
From Joshua Lyon's Pillhead. In the summer of 2003, my co-workers at Jane Magazine and I began receiving massive amounts of email spam offering up Valium, Xanax, and Vicodin with no prescription needed. I kept hitting delete until the words actually sunk into my brain. It couldn't be that easy. So strictly in the name of journalistic curiosity, I convinced my editor to let me try and buy these pills online. The story got approved as a small front-of-book piece in our pop culture section. Even better, I was given a $600 drug budget. I wrote up a quick 250-word blurb about how frighteningly easy it was to order meds online, making a joke about slurring my words a lot ever since, and then took the bottles home. "What are you going to do with those pills?" my editor demanded. "I don't know," I said. "Give them away? I hadn't really thought about it." "Don't worry, I'll get rid of them," I said. "Promise?" she asked. "Flush them down the toilet." "Yes, I promise," I sighed. But it was already a lie.
'Cause I'm a pillhead with the benzo blues.
When I hung up with my boss, I pulled the bottles out of my bag and stared at them. The labels were pathetically generic and looked like they'd been created on a typewriter. The Vicodin bottle was fat, almost 2 inches in diameter. I'd never even seen a pill bottle that large. I opened it and removed the cotton. The pills were thick, the size I'd always called horse pills, and they looked like they'd lodge directly in my windpipe if I tried to swallow one. I took three. That night I drifted in and out of sleep, but not in an unpleasant, restless way. It was more like a constant waking dream. And when the alarm went off the next morning, I still felt a little high, but not at all hungover. That was all it took to seal the deal. I'd discovered my perfect drug. We are back with Joshua Lyon, the author of Pillhead.
What are the telltale signs of addiction to prescription drugs?
They're really subtle, and I think it's also one of the things that contributes to that there being such a giant widespread problem is that it's actually, for a while, at least in the beginning, it can be fairly easy to be a pretty high-functioning addict on these things. There's not a lot of obvious signs, like you don't reek of marijuana, you don't have, you know, coke sniffles, but there are a few telltale signs, pinpointed pupils, acting spacey, memory loss, someone who's having trouble finishing their sentences where they just kind of trail off and forget very obvious words, and also scratching. Opiates can make you itch, so if somebody's kind of scratching their skin a lot in conjunction with all these other symptoms, that is probably a pretty good sign that somebody's using painkillers.
But a lot of people that are doing it don't necessarily just go to their house and, space out. They actually function during the day and go to work and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I to be perfectly honest, in the beginning of my addiction, I didn't see a big, giant problem in my life at first. I was totally able to go to work and continue my career and actually got a few promotions and raises along the way. But what happens is the longer I spent inside that, what I thought was this like warm bubble, what it did was completely cut me off and isolate me from the rest of the world to the point where I basically lost all my friends. It was just totally isolated myself. And then the worst thing that happened is I woke up in the middle of the night with a really bad pain in my belly. I had appendicitis, and I went to the ER, told me I had appendicitis. They said they were going to give me morphine, and I was at the time very excited about that. As soon as the morphine entered my body, I felt high in my head, but it did nothing to actually cure the pain that I was experiencing. My tolerance had risen so high, I had basically blown out all my receptors.
So it was not effective, at least from a pain-killing standpoint.
It was a giant, giant wake-up call. Ironically enough, after I got out of the surgery, I was given my first ever legal prescription for Vicodin. And I was able to get a refill on that and just used those two bottles to kind of slowly wean myself off. I definitely still went through withdrawal, but was able to get a good chunk of sober time in there before another relapse, which sent me to rehab finally.
Is it still a battle for you, Josh?
I mean, honestly, it is. I definitely love having a clear mind again. that part is really great. But, I mean, I'm not going to lie. This is something I'm going to battle for probably, if not the rest of my life, for a long time. There's definitely still a lot of triggers. I mean, people all the time are saying things like, oh, I'm having a really stressful day, I need a Xanax. Even just thinking about things like that is a little difficult for me. And to be honest, even talking about the book sometimes can be hard. A lot of interviewers want to know what the feeling is like. And as I talk to them and explain what the feeling was like, especially in the beginning of my addiction, my body almost still has like a physical little like twinge in there. It's just something I have to keep on every single day. And the most important part of that is communication and really just talking to my friends and family and letting them know when I'm having cravings and when I'm struggling. And I'm lucky that I have a really strong support system.
Yeah, that song made to my soul. It's gonna be just like going home. Yeah, that
no real big thing. We're just kind of dopey folks, and we have all these drugs available to us. You know, that's why there's a drug problem, man. There's all those drug stores, right? Every three or four blocks, there's a big sign.
Drugs.
Open all night.
Drugs.
We deliver.
Drugs.
Cut rate.
Drugs.
It's the biggest thing on this sign, cosmetics.
Drugs.
We are here with Joshua Lyon, the author of Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. You know, from a national standpoint, campaigns like the Just Say No campaign didn't seem to be too effective. What can we do better to educate kids and adults, for that matter, about the dangers of prescription drugs?
I think what needs to happen is that more funding needs to go into the actual study of the nature of addiction itself. I mean, say in a in a perfect scenario, in this like war on drugs, they are able to eliminate one entire class of drugs. That's not going to stop the problem. There's always going to be another substance out there that people are going to be addicted to, and the problem is the actual, I think, biological and mental nature of addiction itself. That's where I think our efforts need to go, is understanding that.
And that's really a longer-term education.
It's a really, really long-term education. But I'm a big believer that the conversation about drugs does have to start in the home, and I think it needs to start early. I mean, if I had an answer for how to cure it, I'd be a rich man. But I just really think it's communication and parents speaking really honestly with their children about it. And I think maybe part of that conversation needs to be that instead of presenting drugs as something like terrifying, maybe just be honest with kids. Be like, look, people do fall into it because in the very beginning, sometimes for some people, they might feel good on them. But then to really, really just explain where exactly it will lead you, it's really just understanding that all of your actions have consequences.
What about the medical profession? Do they have any culpability in this, and can they help, sort of stimulate change also?
Yeah, they can. I think in the beginning, when everyone really started realizing that there was a huge problem here, it was easy for prosecutors to go after doctors who were prescribing these medications because that was the paper trail that was easiest to follow in terms of where the prescriptions were coming from. And there were definitely, and still are, some very unscrupulous doctors that are filling prescriptions just to make money off of them. But I think for the most part, doctors in the medical community are pretty smart and understand that tolerance to a medication and building a tolerance to a medication when it's being prescribed correctly is very different than, you know, becoming mentally addicted to it. I think for the most part, doctors are pretty good about that, and they're pretty aware now, and I think a lot of doctors are nervous about prescribing these medications for fear of being prosecuted, but I also don't know how good a thing that is, because I'd hate the idea of a cancer patient not being able to get access to a painkiller because jerks like me have been abusing them.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, but the medical profession definitely has to have some responsibility in this whole thing, and especially from an educational standpoint and looking at alternatives for patients. Of course, in the extreme examples of a cancer patient, you've got to ease the pain, but I think there's a lot of gray areas there where prescription drugs are abused.
Yeah, well, and I think even more so than the medical community, though, it's the pharmaceutical companies that need to be held accountable for the way that a lot of these drugs were initially marketed. I think there needs to be a lot more research that goes into them. I don't think they should be putting out painkillers that can be easily abused. You have something like OxyContin where you take it orally and it's a time-released formula, but the way to get around that is you just crush and snort it. I mean, I have heard that that company is working on a form of that medication where you wouldn't be able to get the kind of euphoric rush by crushing and snorting. But, I mean, that seems like something that should have been taken care of a long time ago.
Yeah, that's for sure. What's been the reaction to your book?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I was really scared, and I'm still scared about it's nerve-wracking to put a lot of personal details into a book that's also coming at it from a journalistic point of view. But I think the fact that I had a personal experience and a personal stake in all this really helped me get access to a lot of other people that had similar experiences that might not have been as willing to speak to somebody about what they had gone through. It's been overwhelmingly great. I feel like every time I get a letter or an email from somebody who said they just put the book down and are going that day to look for some sort of treatment, I mean, that's what makes it worth it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you really put yourself out there, Josh, and I think you're to be commended for that. The name of the book is Pillhead. Joshua, how can we find out more about it?
You can get it on Amazon. I have a website called pillheadthebook.com. I blog there, and I also blog for the Huffington Post.
CBS News Update. We'll be right back with more What's at Risk.